Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid.
This is definitely a blue-collar community, and I'm kind of a blue-collar guy.
Rick Sealscott didn't see himself as a farmer, but wasn't about to sell his grandparents' Ohio farm. An Avangrid wind farm pays millions to the community and landowners like him each year.
Farming's up and down, but the wind turbines give us steady income. We're holding on to the farm, and we're making money. And I would absolutely do it again.
Discover where energy meets humanity at avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, 2 months after the violence in Charlottesville, 200 employees of the ACLU have signed a secret letter saying the organization's, quote, rigid commitment to the First Amendment is undermining a broader commitment to racial justice, raising the question, will the American Civil Liberties Union rethink its approach to the biggest civil liberty of all? It's Monday, October 9th. So we're going to jump in.
Okay.
And am I saying your name? Am I saying your name correctly? Is it Aubrey?
It's Aubrey.
Aubrey.
Aubrey, yeah.
So I'm putting too much ah in there. So it's Aubrey.
Yes, that's perfect.
Okay, Aubrey. Great, great, great. How did you first learn about the rally?
I actually was at home doing some work and someone posted about the rally on Twitter, and I turned on my TV. I grew up in the South, and when I was in high school, I saw the KKK march through our Martin Luther King parade, and it just brought back memories of a time where it really wasn't safe to be a Black person. One of the reasons that I worked for the ACLU was because of my experience growing up, being called the N-word in the third grade, you know, being a Black person in the South just in general. I wanted to work for an organization that could help advance racial justice, where I could make an impact for communities.
So you're watching the news, you're seeing on Twitter that this rally is going on, and you quickly understand its scale and its meaning. What did you learn about the origins of the rally?
Well, one of the things that I learned was that the ACLU of Virginia helped them to secure a permit to be involved in this rally.
And what was that discovery like for you?
It was shocking. I felt very conflicted. You know, in my opinion, and this does not necessarily represent that of the organization, on one hand, I firmly believe in the First Amendment and free speech and free expression. But, you know, as a Black person, I was hearing from community members, I was hearing from friends asking me, do you really care about racial justice? Do you really care about us?
If you're representing white nationalists.
Yes. Yes.
So they see you and the ACLU as choosing free speech over racial justice, and choosing to elevate the rights of white supremacists over the harms that it can inflict on people of color.
Right. It can be more challenging than I would like to admit on a day-to-day basis.
The idea that free speech is now a source of controversy within the organization is pretty extraordinary.
Joseph Goldstein has been reporting on the ACLU for The Times.
Whenever the ACLU does anything, they attract a lot of attention and a lot of criticism. What made this different was that some of their membership and a good fraction of their staff were very uncomfortable.
Critics on both the left and the right say it's time for the ACLU to rethink how they defend the First Amendment.
And a lot of people blamed the violence on
them. We asked, the city of Charlottesville asked for that to be moved out of downtown Charlottesville to a park about a mile and a half away.
The governor, when asked about this, sort of underscored the ACLU's involvement.
We were unfortunately sued by the ACLU, and the judge ruled against us. That rally.
People said that the ACLU had blood on their hands.
Use quote, sometimes standing on the wrong side of history in defense of a cause you think is right is still just standing on the wrong side of history.
Abrae, when did you first hear about a letter going around your office?
So there, I'd say within a week or so, is kind of when people started having conversations.
So there's a letter in late August addressed, Dear Anthony, Anthony Romero, the ACLU's executive director. The letter states that the problem with representing white supremacists is not that we disagree with them. It is that doing so advances their racist agenda in a country where they have great strength and where institutional and structural racism continues to give some speakers greater power than others. And the letter goes on to state that our broader mission, which includes advancing the racial justice guarantees in the Constitution and elsewhere, not just the First Amendment, continues to be undermined by our rigid stance.
I signed it. I thought it was important when we make these decisions. It does. It causes me to have to grapple with what that representation means in a way that might be different for someone who can look at it just in a very theoretical way. It felt very real.
In other words, this was not a theoretical exercise in what it means to represent speech that you may find deeply offensive and abhorrent, but this was as real as it gets, and you wanted to communicate what it felt like for it to be that real.
Yeah.
How many people inside the ACLU signed this letter of dissent?
So I'm told more than 200 out of a total of about 1,300 full-time staff members.
So a good number of people.
Yeah, and it's pretty extraordinary that within the ACLU there's a debate over what type of free speech cases it should be taking, because for most of 100 years, it's been all free speech cases.
Right, and that seems like a given.
Wherever there's government censorship of any idea, they step in, and they're pretty much the only ones who do that.
Tell me about the town of Skokie, Illinois.
The village of Skokie, Illinois is heavily Jewish, and at this moment in time, the late 70s, there's an unusual concentration of Holocaust survivors who have settled there.
Skokie's 70,000 middle-income people have attracted a lot of business, but Skokie has also attracted a neo-Nazi group and a lot of controversy.
And that's what drew Frank Collin of the National Socialist Party of America to want to march there in the late 1970s.
Party leader Frank Collin says he's inviting Nazis from all over the United States to hold a demonstration at Skokie on the 4th of July.
We decided in 1977 to force the issue in an area where the concept of white power was most opposed, that being Skokie, which has a large Jewish population.
So why did they pick the village of Skokie? It was to produce the most shock. And get the most attention and provoke the most controversy, which is why we're still talking about it nearly 40 years later.
One day in 1977, I got a call from Collin. And
the head of this little band of Nazis, Frank Collin, he has a lot of trouble marching anywhere. So when the village of Skokie denies his application or puts up too many barriers, he picks up the phone and calls the ACLU office and quickly connects with David Goldberger, his counsel.
And he asked if the ACLU would represent him. And frankly, what happened is I called around to find other lawyers who could step in, and I called seven or eight lawyers from major firms, and they all said, not this one, which meant that it was going to be me. I was raised a Jew. I'm a Jew today. There were people in Skokie that were a lot like my relatives. So it was a tough case.
We oppose Nazis wherever they go. Skokie, go! So much pain in us, so much memories. I wake up now as I get older, I wake up sometimes during the night and I'm just out of myself. I can go back to sleep and I don't know what to do. As a man which went through hell, I'm very, very against it.
Appreciate the anguish that you create with your presence, especially for those who have tattoos on their arm, those who lost. You're smiling in sort of almost a kind of...
Waiting for the chance to reply.
My question should not provoke a smile in you, Mr. Collins.
Not only do I appreciate it, I calculated upon it. I use the hysteria of the Jewish community, in Skokie especially, to propel the issue of First Amendment rights for National Socialists and for people.
So you disagreed with perhaps their sentiment, but you were representing their right to express that sentiment. What was that like for you?
Well, I came out of a household where that was a value that was taught at the dinner table.
What do you mean?
Well, when I was a kid, we would sit around the dinner table. My dad was at the head of the table. We would be talking about current events and the battles over integration, you know, and he'd talk about it in terms of neutral principles that everybody, no matter their race, is entitled to equal treatment, and what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Is that what he actually said at the dinner table, or what did he say?
Sure, that's precisely what he said. No matter how offensive you were or your beliefs were, everybody has a right to fair and equal treatment under the law. You can't make exceptions because you don't like the people or you don't agree with them. And I absorbed those values really at the time without realizing how important they would become to me.
Nazis have no rights! Nazis have no rights! Nazis have no rights!
I still, at the beginning, I knew people were angry. But I had no idea how angry until the case just exploded. Then the ACLU had thousands of resignations. The threats began to pick up. There were physical threats, phone calls that, you know, one said, well, I'm going to blow your head off.
Wow.
The Jewish Defense League showed up with ball bats at our office. Walked into the lobby and swung the ball bats into the air and turned around and left.
David, it sounds like a lot of fellow Jews felt that you had betrayed them. Is that what?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So, David, looking back at that case, how does it make you feel now?
I'm proud that I did it. Just that simple. I really did I feel profoundly that I did the right thing. It became a paradigm or a teaching example about the importance of the First Amendment and about the importance of neutral principles.
And what's the lesson that it taught?
It taught that everyone has the right to speak so long as they play by the rules.
This moment you're describing after Skokie, where many parts of the country are up in arms over the decision to allow this protest and to champion the rights of these Nazis, it feels like it echoes the backlash to Charlottesville. What's actually different about Charlottesville and Skokie?
So a few things, and let's go through them. One is, after sort of putting Skokie on the national map and starting a searing conversation about free speech and the rights of hate speech, the march never happens. Everybody sort of assumes it did. It's Nazis in Skokie, but they never ended up marching there, probably to their relief, because by the end it didn't seem that they were going to be able to get that many Nazis to show up.
Where's our banners? I don't see. Where are the banners?
When they would have a rally, they'd be lucky if three or four dozen people showed up.
We need an extension cord.
They didn't bring it?
No, they didn't bring it.
Oh, shit. You know where it is?
You know, they would sometimes be outnumbered by counter-protesters 70-1.
They can't even see us.
Isn't that really pathetic,
though? Oh, bullshit.
Look at this. They can't. No one sees the police.
Their ideas might be hateful and fearsome, but
their presence, it sounds like,
was much less so. And the white supremacist movement is at the moment emboldened and larger and to many much more fearsome than it was a few decades ago. That was a big torchlit rally on the Friday night before that march. And this didn't feel like just a measly turnout of a dozen fringe white supremacists.
Which was the case in Skokie.
Skokie.
David, how has the Charlottesville case changed the ACLU?
I'm not sure that it's changed the ACLU at all. Remember, in Skokie, I think I told you, there were thousands of resignations and objections. The ACLU has always been a place where when you get into difficult cases, cases that are extremely controversial, that a lot of people discover that the ACLU wasn't exactly what they thought it was. That was true back during the Skokie case, and I think it's true today. And hopefully, they'll come around. If not, they really need to think about whether they should be working for the Lawyers Guild or People for the American Way.
David, it sounds like the critique, as I understand it, is not that white nationalists in Charlottesville should have been censored in any way, but instead that the ACLU has a limited amount of resources.
It's a cop-out.
And
it's just a cop-out. If it has a limited number of resources and therefore should only take important cases, what case could be more important than Charlottesville right now with regard to the First Amendment in light of the reaction and the discussion that's ongoing about it? It's a cop-out.
So these inflammatory cases, Charlottesville, Skokie, you see them as the most important cases because of their prominence, and therefore the ACLU should take them.
They reinforce basic principles like First Amendment right to freedom of speech that are always thrown into question when people are controversial enough.
Mm-hmm.
And to back away from those cases, as far as I'm concerned, is a cop-out.
Abrey, one of your colleagues that we spoke to, David Goldberger, worked in the famous Skokie, Illinois case. He thinks that to not take the case of the white nationalists and the white supremacists in Charlottesville is, in his words, a cop-out. He kept using that word. It would be a cop-out, kind of constitutionally, to not take up that case. What do you say to that?
I think that, you know, if we know the disparate impacts of bringing cases that are going to harm communities of color, why shouldn't that be part of the calculus of moving forward with certain cases? Again, we definitely should uphold the principles of free speech, free expression. I also think that there are other parts of the Constitution that we also work to uphold, like the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. And, you know, that
which
was
is about, which is about equal protection.
Which is about equal protection. I want us to make sure that we are considering all parts of the Constitution.
Finally, Joe, do you think that the ACLU will actually change its official policies because of what happened in Charlottesville?
No. Though how many free speech absolutists are still on the board? I guess we'll find out. But the expectation is that no, the ACLU, the board is not going to dramatically change any policies. However, most of the work on these First Amendment free speech cases is done sort of at the local affiliate office. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Richard Spencer wants to, the alt-right ideologue, when he wants to go speak at a university and the university says no, his lawyer will sort of file an intake form online with the ACLU office in Alabama or in Texas and hope that somebody calls them back. And if these staffers are the ones on the receiving end of those intake forms or the ones who sort of pick up the phone and actually decide whether or not to take a complaint, they could very easily decide that, no, the ACLU is not going to be representing a lot of white supremacists going forward just by virtue of not returning a phone call and dragging their heels.
So essentially, these lawyers on the ground could remake the policies on their own just by not getting back to somebody who wants their help, by not answering the call when a white supremacist
absolutely. The call
it.
Comes in on Thursday, call back the following Wednesday, by which point there's a good chance the rally might have already happened.
Or not happened.
Or not happened.
All right, we're live. We're live. Might as well run it. Good time.
Hey, guys.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Go.
We are peacefully here.
Yes. We're not breaking any law, in fact.
Well, on Saturday night, white nationalists returned to Charlottesville for a rally in the same park where they gathered in August.
You will not replace us!
You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
Carrying tiki torches, about 40 demonstrators marched for 10 minutes, led by the white supremacist Richard Spencer, and then dispersed without incident. Because the rally was under 50 people, no permit from the city of Charlottesville was required. A spokesman for the city told the local paper, quote, "While we prefer protesters get permits, like any other event, such assemblies are protected by the First Amendment, and we do not interfere unless we perceive a legal or safety issue." We'll be right back.
What can a painting of Queen Elizabeth I teach us about power? And how did tattoos become both revered and reviled? Hi, I'm Isabella Rossellini, and in the first episode of This Is Not a Beauty Podcast, we'll hear from a top Capitol Hill makeup artist and meet the world's oldest tattooist to understand how beauty shapes politics. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform, brought to you by L'Oréal Group.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents, and they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.
I use New York Times cooking at least 3 to 4 times a week.
I love sheet pan bibimbap. It said 35 minutes. It was 35 minutes.
The cucumber salad with soy, ginger, and garlic. Oh my God, that is just to die for.
This turkey chili has over 17,000 five-star ratings. So easy, so delicious.
The instructions are so clear, so simple, and it just works.
Hey, it's Eric Kim from New York Times Cooking. Come cook with us. Go to nytcooking.com.
Here's what else you need to know today. The Times reports that before agreeing to allow young undocumented immigrants, known as Dreamers, to stay legally in the U.S., President Trump will demand that Congress harden the southern U.S. border to prevent the entry of children fleeing violence in Central America. The White House argues that by allowing tens of thousands of those children into the country over the past few years, the U.S. is creating an endless stream of sympathetic young immigrants who will continue to seek amnesty. And President Trump and Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee engaged in an extraordinary public clash over the weekend after Corker said this about the president's cabinet.
Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos. And I support them very much.
When you say that Tillerson, Mattis, and Kelly are separating this country from chaos, do you mean from the president's chaos?
Well, it's just they act in a very, they work very well together to make sure.
On Sunday, the president tweeted that Corker had decided not to run for re-election because, quote, he didn't have the guts, Senator Corker responded with his own tweet, saying, quote, "It's a shame that the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning." Later on Sunday, Corker told The Times that Trump's behavior risks setting off World War III. Corker's support will be critical to the White House on upcoming tax reform and a vote on the future of the Iran nuclear deal. Finally, Harvey Weinstein has been fired 3 days after The Times reported on decades of sexual harassment allegations against him. The Hollywood mogul had taken a leave of absence on Friday after apologizing for his behavior toward women. On Sunday, the directors of the Weinstein Company notified him by email that he had been terminated for violating the company's code of conduct. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.